Grade 7 Conference, Lecture 67, Physiology Part 6, A Little More on the Heart. Now, obviously, in these lectures, I am not going through every anatomical and physiological, morphological detail about the organic systems I'm discussing. That you can get from a book. And you'll also see some aspects of this in the student work slideshow as well. But what I want to talk about more here is, number one, some aspects of the anthroposophical understanding of these organs. And believe me, we are barely scratching the surface. Rudolf Steiner said so much about the human organism, the most perfect creation on the earth. So I'm just giving you a little here and there. And as I said earlier, I'm doing this because, like it or not, unless you want to completely revamp the human physiology block, what you're talking about is almost exclusively aspects of the human being that comes from Steiner's understanding. Then that either you've read directly, especially if you're into the medical lectures or something like that. Very difficult, but very interesting lectures to read. Good for teachers to take up. Or you've read other aspects of things like Steiner's and occult physiology, or the tens of thousands of references that he makes to different organs in almost every lecture he ever gave. If you've got that, then you can do something very creative and original. But most likely, you are going to be doing what's in the books about teaching physiology, something like the Charles Kovacs book, Muscles and Bones. Excellent book. But please remember what he is giving there and saying, this is how this happens, this is how that happens. A lot of that is an acceptance of what Rudolf Steiner said happens or doesn't happen without telling you that, with, you know, acting as though, well, of course, everyone knows it works like this and that. And a lot of physiologists, a lot of doctors might say, that's not the way it is at all. So you have to be cautious here. You have to be awake. And I'm trying to share with you ways in which we can take Steiner's ideas and pictures, which I personally believe on the deepest level are true and even accurate, but make some sense of them for seventh graders without in any way standing in the way of their later being able to become physiologists, nurses, physicians, and live in the modern materialistic world conception and not feel my Waldorf education stood in the way of this, or it tried to turn me away from this. Listen, for Waldorf schools to go forward, dear friends, we need a few more doctors. I mean, they can contribute big bucks to the life of a school, right? Okay, let's go on. More about the heart. The heart is a pump, another approach to trying to understand this. So one aspect I gave you, the hydraulic ram. So one might say that the circulatory momentum of the blood itself is actually what pushes the blood through the heart and makes the heart as a muscle is then reacting, responding. All that the heart really does, we might say, out of its own musculature on one level is just to momentarily pause that flow, which happens in the hydraulic ram as well. It's really amazing. You see this streaming, maybe under high water pressure from a faucet or a hose, going through, and this thin, delicate-looking glass device, the hydraulic ram, stops it for a split second, and then up it goes, uphill, shoots up out of nowhere. So it's this stopping for a moment that really empowers the blood to go forward. Otherwise, the heart is really an organ of response. And one can go further than this, and I can show the children how the heart is actually, even in its physical substantiality, even in its structure, it is formed by the blood. And we start here, and unfortunately for maybe a third or two-thirds of you, this is not going to work, but at least you can experience it yourself sometime and tell the students about it. Ideally, you have near the school grounds a stream, a wide stream, a narrow stream, doesn't matter that much. And come January, when the frosts really start to become more set and permanent for the winter, go every day before the physiology block, or time the physiology block so it's taking place in the winter. Every day you go and look and see where it is starting to freeze. Where is the ice forming? Now, like anything else in nature, it's rhythmical, and some days it may have warmed up suddenly and the ice is melted and you go back again and it's forming anew. But always the general trend is that the ice is forming near the bank, at the edge, or it's forming on a little islet, which is in the stream. That is to say, wherever the water is moving most slowly, wherever the water is most shallow, that's where the ice will form first. And where, let's say, it hits a little branch in the water and stops for a split second, there again, that will ice up first. And that is where, as we are watching the stream almost icing over completely, we know that the ice is thickest and where you can walk on it most dependably near the edges rather than right in the middle. That's going to take the longest. What happens then? As the ice forms at the peripheral parts near the two banks of the stream, that ice then in turn narrows the channel that the water has to flow, which actually creates greater pressure. And you may have studied some hydraulics in grade 6 or even this year. That greater pressure then speeds the water up and makes it that less likely that it's going to ice up in the middle. There'll be that much more resistance to the icing up. That way, the same amount of water can be flowing through that stream as flowed before it started to ice up. So the stream keeps the same volume of water flowing through it by increasing the pressure. So it's working now at a greater speed. And you'll see again where there are little impediments here and there, suddenly you can have an icing up, which doesn't allow that pressure to continue. Now, we talk about this, we just observe this, so this is really phenomenological. You know, I'm not feeding them any concepts. We're watching what's going on. And once again, I'm not telling you you must approach it this way, but I'm saying that this will help you when you and the parents may have a little argument about the heart as a pump or not, or when you, like me, go to divorce court and have to testify about this. You have to go a bit into embryology for this, which is ordinarily not what people are told to do in this physiology class. That's reserved for high school. But you can do it. And you can do a couple of things. One of them is to talk about the embryology of the heart and to show that what actually happens is there is blood in the body. Of course there is. It's the mother's blood via the umbilical tube, the umbilical cord, that is flowing into the newly forming embryonic baby. And what is happening is that that blood is in one place or another starting to slow down in its flow. It's not going to freeze, of course, but just as water that slows down is more prone to become solid, that is ice, So blood that slows down is more prone to clot. It starts to clot, it starts to congeal, it starts to thicken ever so little. And this thickening, in turn, does two things. Number one, it slows down the blood flowing near it, so that starts to thicken as well. On the other hand, the blood that is not yet in that thickening influence is increased in pressure. It starts to speed up and deliver more volume. And before long, and this is a very remarkably rapid process, you have a big congealed glob there, which has blood flowing through it in a rhythmical way. You start to get the mother's pulsing reflected in this globular collection of clots. This is the beginning of the heart. The blood comes first, the heart comes second. It's obvious. There wouldn't be an embryo there. There wouldn't be a fetus there if it wasn't that there's already the mother's blood there. So we have here kind of the chicken and the egg question, but there's no question that there is blood in that embryo before there is a heart. Blood first, heart second. And according to Steiner, that prototype continues throughout our life, that it's the flow of the blood that's first, it's the heart reflecting the flow of that blood. You know, any more than one can say you put a little rubber duck in the water in a stream and the rubber duck starts to move down the stream quickly. Is that because the duck is flapping its feet so quickly? And I mean, obviously not. It's a rubber duck. It's simply following the stream and going along with it. And it's very funny because we know it's not really swimming, but for all practical purposes, it looks like a duck moving in the water. The heart is something like that as well. And I'm not saying that to denigrate the heart at all. It's a wonderful, important organ. So that's another way of presenting it. You can also, and I've done this with one class, it will depend a bit on how quickly you can move, how comfortable you are with this sort of stuff yourself. Another way of working with the heart, which is really lovely, is going back to your zoology block in grade 4 and talking about the kind of kingdoms, you know, subkingdoms of the animals. What is the heart like in the fish? Very, very interesting. The heart is essentially like two running forms in form drawing, two wave forms. You know, separated by an invisible horizontal line mirroring each other. The heart of the fish is simply allowing fluid to flow through. There is definitely a rhythmical pulsing going on, but there is no separating of the blood into venous and arterial blood. What's next in line? The heart of the bird. Or I'd say rather, excuse me first, the heart of the reptile. There again, reptilian heart has a slight, delicate, membranous separation, hardly anything there. The cold-blooded reptile, however, again, does not really have anything differentiating arterial and venous blood, and it cannot generate its own warmth. The first time that we see a real separation of the heart into something like two chambers is in the crocodile. And that already is a very big reptile, kind of, you know, which obviously is much more awake to its environment, not just to the flies that are near it. Then we go on to the birds. Here we have something approaching a true valving of the heart, a true chambering of the heart. And then in the mammal, we see the four-chambered heart for the first time. So, okay, that's interesting. Let's look back again at these animals. What do fish do with their eggs? They release them into the water and they keep swimming. They release millions of them because they, you know, inherently there's a wisdom knowing only a few will not get eaten by other fish. So the fish has no connection to its young. Even the salmon, you know, which makes such sacrifices to spawn, it does not stay with its eggs. Nor do most reptiles either. They lay them and they leave. We see in the higher reptiles, the turtle buries them and protects them a bit and leaves. The crocodile starts to stay in closer proximity. So the bird, they sit on their eggs. They keep them warm. The mammal carries the egg within it, does not release it until it is ready to go into the world, and then remains with that for a period of time, a year, or with a human being, much longer. Isn't that interesting? Look at the heart, and you are going to be able to tell whether that creature is capable of nurturing, and we might say even loving, its young, or whether it just is giving them up to the world. What else is true about these animals? Fish are not capable of making an inner sound. Reptiles begin to be able to make something of a sounding, though for many of them it's simply an external rubbing, like an insect. Birds can tell us something about their inner life. We feel joy when we hear the song of the cardinal or the blue jay. We feel a mournful quality when we hear the sound of the mourning dove. We feel something of that inner life of that bird can be manifested. The mammal, many, many different sounds. We get to know very well whether they're happy or not, or want something or don't. And the human being, with a fully developed four-chambered heart, venous blood, arterial blood, a separation, a series of walls going on there we can speak. We have speech. We are able to express our inner life. The older we get, in a more articulated, nuanced way, we can even do creative writing at a certain point and really speak out of ourselves. So that's another way of looking at the heart. And you're looking at it, you know, very objectively, very scientifically. There's no question what I've told you about those hearts is basically accurate. Any scientist, physiologist will agree with that. But you're still bringing into it a quality of soul. And I'd say that's the important thing when you're teaching physiology. You don't get goopy and sentimental about it, you know. You don't just give Steiner's picture again and again and again unless you really know that inside and out, but you keep it ensouled. Don't feel, oh, I have to do these children a big favor and, you know, have them draw the heart and get all the valves right and get it labeled. Absolutely, but only if you are bringing that with heart and soul yourself. And that's the big challenge for us. In a few of these science blocks where basically we're just mechanically, in a conforming way, doing what our mentor says, doing what our school's already done, using all the source material. And, you know, parents feel we're just, you know, saying Steiner says, not to the children, but basically to ourselves. And the children just feel, you know, well, I don't know. I mean, whatever you're feeding them, they want to believe that you're their teacher, they're accepting it, but make sure that it is real to you. And I think of all of the organs that we teach about, it is the heart that is really the most critical in terms of really bringing it in an accurate way.